We are continuing through this series of People in a Place, following kind of the whole story of the Old Testament. There's been a lot to cover, and we've kind of just run through it all. So it's been fun. But I think we're coming towards the end of it. We've gotten through a lot of the big narrative of God working in creation, God working through his people, bringing them into a place where he can reside with them, where he can build relationship and bring them back into this kind of place and position where he can walk among them again. And we jumped from the narrative of the Torah into kind of the prophetic writings and some sort of commentary on what was going on back there. And now we're getting into the writings, this section of the Old Testament or of the Hebrew Bible, like we're kind of going through now, that are providing some more commentary on what these people were going through and on the heart of God and that kind of thing. So today, what I want to go through really quickly is a little story, a little book called Job. Maybe misleading, calling it a little story. It's actually a very hefty book. If you've read through it, you know it's just this big, densely packed book of dialogue made up of this complicated Hebrew poetry for most of it. And the story itself doesn't really seem to fit into that larger narrative of the Old Testament. We get this completely different character, a completely different place than we're used to. It's not set in the land of Israel. It's not set in any of the places that we've heard of before. It's actually set in the East. That's kind of all that we get, is that Job is of the people of the East. So we know that it's not talking about the Israelites, the people of God that we've been hearing about so far. And so the question that we've got to ask is, like, what's it doing here? Why are we hearing about this? What is it doing? So part of the genre of the Hebrew writings, which again were kind of this commentary on the narrative that was going on, is a genre known as the wisdom literature. The wisdom literature is made up of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job, mostly. Does anybody here know of Aesop's Fables? Yeah, I thought so. It's been around for a while. I remember growing up. That's not a dig on you guys. I grew up with it as well. I remember as a kid watching animated Aesop's Fables, and it was like, I think the tortoise and the hare was in it. I don't know if they were supposed to be, but that was the story that I remember from it. But it was kind of this odd collection, originally written by a Greek philosopher, I believe. And it was supposed to be telling these stories about human character and about morality, but telling them through animal characters doing different things. And while wisdom literature is not quite the same as that, it's not just some, like, ooh, nice little moral stories with these random animal characters, it is another odd collection of writings intended to help its audience understand and navigate their reality, understand the proper order of things. It's kind of asking this question: what does it look like to live well in this world? What does it look like to live wisely, to align yourself with how things should be, or how we were created to live? So these books, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job, if you have read them at all, you know they are very complex. They're very difficult to understand. It's not very straightforward. But I think that's because what they're trying to deal with is life. It's reality. And life and reality and people are just very complex. So there's a lot to pull from these books, a lot of lessons that can be learned, a lot of of little rabbit trails to go off on in studying these. And so in order to stay on track, I just want to focus on one idea today in Job. It's an idea that runs, I think, throughout the whole book of Job and kind of pulls together a lot of its themes. And it's this idea that God is worth worshiping. God is worth worshiping. And we'll dive into that more. But that's going to be kind of this golden thread that we're going to be holding that's going to help us find our way through the book. So if you'd like to turn with me to Job, we're going to jump right into the story, starting with the very beginning. Job 1, starting in verse 1 through verse 3. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. What a guy. Ooh, cool dude. This is immediately we get this introduction to this character, Job. And we see a couple of things I think are really important, to the author. Some things that the author really wants us to see about this man, Job. The first of these things is that Job had it all. Job had everything. He had family, he had wealth, he had land, he had 400 female donkeys, 500 female donkeys, everything you could ever need right there. And the second thing was that Job deserved to have it all. Job was not just in his position because he had, you know, taken advantage of people or whatever. He was there because he was a righteous man. It starts out, his like first description is that he's blameless and upright. So he was a wise, upstanding man, and he was being rewarded for it. This description, this setting that the author has placed us in right off the bat, is a world that is ordered properly, a world that is running the way that we would expect in a system designed by a good, all-powerful God. And so it's like, okay, yeah, obviously, this is nice. We could end here and be okay with it. This kind of world is one that is displayed really well in the book of Proverbs. So that's another one of those wisdom writings. And if you dive into the book of Proverbs, it's kind of this big, weird collection of sayings and advice and stuff like that. But the point of Proverbs, or at least a big theme in Proverbs, is that there is a clear structure to the world, that there is an order that God has woven through reality. And if we're wise, we can actually tap into that order. We can align ourselves with it and live rightly. And when we do that, things go smoothly for us. If we do good things, good things happen to us. If we live wisely, we will receive the fruit of our labor and of our wisdom. And likewise, if we live foolishly or if we are wicked, then bad things will happen to us. We'll see that things don't go smoothly for us. So that's the system set up by Proverbs, and a system that a lot of people really latch onto because it feels nice. It's good, and I think that there's a reason for that. But it's easy in this system, in this Proverbs view of reality, it's easy to see how God would be worth worshiping. If God has ordered things so that when I do good things, I get good things in return, obviously I would worship him. If when I worship God, I get good things in return, I get what I want, why wouldn't I worship God? So we're kind of perfectly set up for the author to start taking this view of reality and just challenging it a little bit. Just start poking holes in these assumptions about how the world should be ordered, how things should be run. The way that I have been thinking about it as I've approached Job is like all of us readers of this book are coming at it with our little box, a little box of reality, where we've taken everything that we know about how the world is and how it works, and we place it in our little box, and we arrange it nicely so that it all makes sense, and we can understand it, and we can navigate it really well. And the author of Job is just like coming and pulling the tape off the bottom of that box, like just tearing the corners or poking holes in it or something. He's taking this story of Job that's messy and uncomfortable, which we'll see, and oddly shaped, and he's placing it inside our box. And it doesn't quite fit with everything else that we have so far. So what we're being forced to do is either just completely get rid of this story and ignore it entirely, or find out a way to get a new box, or realize that we can't put reality, our view of reality, in a box. So here's how the author does it. As soon as the scene is set on Job, this upstanding, wealthy, successful character, we're all of a sudden whisked away to an entirely new situation, a new setting, the divine council. We're taken into the throne room of God and kind of seeing behind the scenes what's going on with God in the middle of Job's story. So let's go there now. It's in Job 1 again, starting in verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the works of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Again, there's a lot to take out of this, a lot going on, a lot of questions that we have about this. But I think the thing that we should note right off the bat, and that kind of speaks to all of these questions that we have, is just the point that there is more to the story. There is already more forces at play than Job can see, and even that the reader can see. There are more factors to take into account than what we once thought were at play in the world. We, up to this point, haven't heard about the divine council necessarily. We don't know that Satan is allowed to come and talk to God whenever he wants to, or that God will just allow him to meddle in these affairs of people like that. So we have so many questions about things, and I think what we're starting to realize is that we have a lot more rules that we need to fit into our little reality box than we thought at first. And suddenly, this idea of God being worth worshiping is taken out of that nice little neat environment and placed into a much more complex, messy space, the space of suffering. What we see right after this scene is actually, it's kind of mirrored in these two stories. So there's this one, and then the second chapter is this kind of happening again. And at the end of both of these stories, what happens is Satan goes and just wrecks Job's life, kills his family, destroys his land, his wealth is all taken away. After the end of the second story, God allows Satan to affect Job physically, his own body, and Job ends up with these sores, like scraping himself with a piece of pottery on the ground, and he is just like in shambles. Everything has been taken away from him. And I think this is where we get to the real meat and potatoes of Job, is this question of what do we do with suffering if we want to believe that we have a God worth worshiping? What do we do with good people experiencing bad things, experiencing pain, if we want to believe that we have a God who has ordered things well, ordered things to be good? And this is why Job is such a beautiful book, because as it steps into this messy realm of suffering, it's stepping right into the heart of every human being. Not everybody can relate to having incredible wealth or having a large family or having a bunch of money or success or anything like that. And certainly none of us can relate to living completely blameless lives, to being upstanding all the time. But every single person here can relate to suffering, can relate to experiencing loss or betrayal or shame or having our bodies break down or having our plans be dashed. Having taken on this problem of suffering, the story is no longer just about an individual named Job. All of a sudden, this story is about each and every one of us. How can we deal with suffering? How can we find God to be worth worshiping, even when we feel like we're doing everything right and everything is going wrong? So we're eager to see how this book answers our questions, how it wrestles through this topic. And it does it in a very interesting way. After these two stories, we see an introduction of three new characters. Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, an excellent boy band. Not really, but you know. And what takes up a vast majority of the story from here on out is this really dense dialogue between these four people, between Job and his friends. For the sake of time, I won't read all 34 chapters, but I will give you a little bit of a gist of what's going on. It begins in chapter 3 with, first of all, with Job's friends coming up to him and seeing him in the position that he's in the suffering that he's in, and actually going and sitting with him. And they just sit with him in silence for 7 days. The whole week, they're just sitting there with him in his ashes, which I think says something about their character. Like, these are good friends, and they are good people, even if they might be a little bit off on their view of reality. But anyway, so chapter 3, Job, after that time of just sitting in silence with his friends, he finally breaks this silence, and he breaks it with this heartfelt, agonizing poem where he's just crying out, overwhelmed with his frustration and grief at his situation. And the whole thing is just him cursing the day he was born, just saying, it would have been better if I were not. And in what seems to be their very best attempt at consoling Job after this, his friends are like, okay, let's figure out how to fix your situation. Let's figure out what went wrong, how you can do better. We're going to take care of this. It'll all be all right. And the conclusion that they reach is that Job must have done something wrong to deserve this situation. He must have committed some sin and brought this judgment down on his head. Job, however, is adamant in defending his innocence. And so they go back and forth and all around and up and down, and neither side is willing to concede to the other, until finally at the end of the book, God himself has to step in to the conversation. It's important to note I think, with this conversation. I mean, there's a ton in it all and a lot to take out of it. But one thing that's really important is to note the direction of the conversation, the direction of each person's dialogue. Because Job's friends, throughout the whole discussion, were only directed at him. They had all of their preconceived notions about who God was and how he worked and how he had ordered things in reality. And so they spoke for God, but they never spoke to God. They only spoke to Job. And that's a very dangerous game to play. Instead of coming at the situation and realizing that their perspective on God and their perspective on reality might be limited, and that their understanding might be incomplete, and that they would actually maybe need to ask God for understanding like Job did, they try instead to mash Job's situation into a shape that will fit into their little box. They believed that God was worth worshiping, and they were going to defend that fact, but only so long as he acted according to their view of the proper order of things, rewarding the righteous and punishing the wicked. Again, how easily does that become something that we all adopt? That if we do the right things, God will bless us, or even that he ought to bless us, and we try to defend that view of reality or fit everything into that box. And how often have we seen this accusation lobbed against Christianity by people on the outside, that if there really were a God, at least one who is worth worshiping at all, how could he let bad things happen to good people? I think it's just human nature to want things to be ordered sensibly, to desire justice. It's not a bad thing. It's something I think that's after God's heart. But it's incomplete. And we see that with Job's responses. In contrast to his friends, Job's dialogue was directed not only at them, but also at God. He often went straight from responding directly to what his friends had said, to crying out to God, asking God to answer him, to explain why he was in this situation, to test him, to defend his innocence. He was asking for God to step in. And boy, does God respond. In chapter 38, towards the end of the book, we see this like cloud forming, this storm come, and it says that out of a whirlwind, the Lord speaks to Job. And he's basically like, Job, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? I think the actual wording is something like, gird up your loins like a man and answer my questions, which is a terrifying thing to hear from God. But God continues after that. He takes Job up and kind of shows him a glimpse of what is happening in reality. Just shows him like a sliver of what God has to order all the time. He takes him to the mountains and shows him the goats that are living there and shows him the process of birth and growth and life and death and how he is working in the middle of that, making sure that it's all balanced correctly so that these sheep continue to survive in the environment that they're in. And he takes him and shows him the mountains and the valleys and the oceans and everything that's living on it, and shows him the cosmos, the stars, shows him that there is so much more, that creation is so much grander than he could imagine and so much more detailed and intricate and complex. And it kind of ends with God showing Job these two massive beasts. As if Job wasn't awestruck enough at the rest of creation, God shows him this behemoth and leviathan, this massive land creature and sea creature that Job couldn't even imagine coming up against, couldn't imagine facing And God is like, actually, those things that you would cower at, that would just snap you like a twig, I created those things. I have a purpose for those things. I fit those things into the order of creation. He comes to Job and he says, you're asking all of these questions of me. You're asking all of these questions of my motives. And you want to know why things are ordered the way they are, but you don't understand what you're asking. You don't understand how complex and delicate the system is that you're in. The system is that I am holding together. And again, we're surprised as the readers that this is the response of God. The book kind of ends with Job's questions seemingly unanswered. The Lord does not explain to him what led to his sufferings. He says nothing about the divine counsel or about Satan coming in or Job being tested for his righteousness. Pieces of information that we, the readers, would think, yeah, I'd want to know that as Job. I'd want to know that all of this happening to me was just because of this divine counsel. But on all of that, the Lord is silent. Job never finds out about it. And I think that it is in that silence that the author is trying to teach us something. That what's going on behind the scenes doesn't matter as much as we would think. God is worth worshiping regardless. God's goodness and order are infinitely more complex than we can understand. And when we try to simplify the situation to fit into our little box, we end up like Job's friends, comforted by our false view that we have a handle on the situation, but missing the real God entirely. So, is God worth worshiping? The book seems to respond with a resounding yes. Yes, God is worth worshiping. But not because he fits into our neat little box of good people getting good things, of wicked people being punished. God is worth worshiping precisely because his order and his design for reality is so much greater than that. That he works on a scale that is above what we can comprehend. This is great news. This is great news for us. Because if things were ordered the way that we think they should be, where good people get good things, bad people get bad things, we would all be in a lot of trouble. We would all be in a world of hurt. But we know that that's not how God works. We know that he is greater than just punishment and reward for good and bad behavior. We know that he is merciful, that he is gracious, that he is working something together that is so much better than all of that. And he is going to work things together so that we end up in a place where we can live with him and in relationship with him, where we can be his people and he can be our God and we can live in the place that he's created for us. God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Until he comes again, we will suffer. But let's spend the meantime worshiping the God who is worth our worship. Let's pray. God, thank you for being with us this morning. Thank you for moving in our lives behind the scenes, for being so much greater than we can understand or imagine. Thank you that you don't put us in charge of things, that we don't have to be at the helm of ordering all of this creation and deciding what's good and what's not. God, I pray that you would remind us every day of your greatness and your power and your wisdom, and also remind us of your care for us, that you see the details of our lives, and you love the details of our lives. God, help us to be in line with your order. Help us to see you as worthy of our worship. In Jesus' name, amen.